I'd like to talk tonight about trust. I want to talk about trust tonight because trust is an essential part of our true or original nature. It is part of the childlike wonder or awe potential in us all the time. It's not a sophisticated or complex truth. It's remarkably simple, remarkably immediate when we see it, and reliable. And so I want to talk about it because I want to try to uncover some of the ways in which we subtly go to sleep, even as we say or feel, I'm awake. Everybody feel awake? Somewhat? The systems of the body. We easily take for granted, we trust every day that this thing is going to keep breathing, that it's going to digest food, don't have to think about it, don't have to work on it, that it's going to eliminate what it doesn't need, and that that's trustworthy. Some of us, more than others, we trust our intellect. We trust our reasoning. We trust our ability to rationalize. We trust our decision-making process. We trust thought. We use it to discern things. And if we use it to discern things and we make a decision based on that discernment and it goes relatively well, the feedback increases our trust. Some of us trust something in psychology, in some schools of psychology, called the felt sense. The felt sense is connected to things like recognizing when we're hungry, recognizing when we're tired, recognizing when we're rested. And it gets a little more subtle. Recognizing when we're in the presence of someone other, so to speak, that we can trust. Think for a moment about someone in your life. It might easily come to mind. If no one comes to mind, it's okay. That you trust. And why do you trust them? Because they tell the truth, maybe? Because their actions and what they say are relatively aligned? They're consistent? You feel that they care about you. They have empathy. They can put themselves in your shoes. You like them. And so you trust them. You also have this felt sense that says, you know what, I don't really trust this person so much. I don't really trust this situation here so much. I don't trust what's really going down. I don't really feel entirely good about this. You know, something's a little funny here. You're a little like, you make me feel unsure. I'm not sure about your motives. What are you up to? Do you have my best interests in mind? Do you even know what best interests are? Do you have your best interests in mind? Sometimes there's people who aren't behind the wheel of their car very well. And you don't feel like you want to get too close to riding in the car with them. One of the members of my immediate family, my father-in-law, passed away about 3 weeks ago. And there was a point years ago when I would visit him and my mother-in-law with my wife and children, we'd go and visit. And he's a very intense guy, very, very opinionated. And I learned very quickly with him what not to talk about. Like all the stuff I'm talking about here, don't talk about. Pretty much like right up there, 98, 99%. But here's what happened. There's a forest monastery, one of the first in America. It's called Bhavana Society. It's in High Point, West Virginia. It's in this, what I call a fjord without water in the middle. You know, a fjord is like this with the water down the thing. So just do this without the water. Stick a road there. And you go down the road to the forest monastery. And in those days, it was very rustic. But I felt very connected to the place. I felt very connected to this Sri Lankan monk. And I, you know, set it up to go on this, like, self-retreat there, you know, like, after a few days of visit with the in-laws. I'm going to go off to the retreat. And so my father-in-law says, I'll drive you. And I immediately felt uncomfortable. Because one of the things he does, or did, with the Scirocco, was he was always punching the gas. So he'd be like, it was like, just, can we go even? And it just was like, why are we doing it like this? And it wasn't, I hope you can appreciate, the kind of guy that you're going to say, hey, can I ask you about your experience? Like, how do you feel? Why are you doing this? There's certain places you don't go because you trust that it might be worse if you go there. So just stay out of that space. We get up to the monastery, and then his discomfort overflows when he sees this bald, brown, orange-robed thing called a monk coming towards us with a big smile. More hair, this is great, more hair growing out of the ears than the top of the head. Completely unself-conscious about like a handlebar mustache coming out of the sides. You don't see this very often. People cut that stuff off. Bald with hair growing out. I don't know whether my father-in-law saw that or not, but I got one look in his eyes and I saw what I want to say I trust was terror. But it was not a like shaking outward, you know, visible, easily seen terror. It was very, very guarded. And he looked me in the eye and he said one word, bye. And then he got in the Scirocco and he burned rubber in the driveway as he backed out. Down the road. He's trusting something. I'm trusting something different. Sometimes we begin to trust that the mind that says, this is right, this is wrong, this is better, this is worse, is not trustworthy. That it's actually deluded. It's prejudiced, it's biased, it's opinionated, and it's locked into itself. Something starts to trust as delusion is seen. Delusion, not seeing things clearly. That's what it means. Something starts to trust that delusion doesn't have to operate and run my life. A couple more examples. Every night, at night, it's great. We trust sleep. We just trust it. Forget about all our problems. Forget about the body. Forget about the mind. Forget about the breathing. Forget about everything. Forget it all. Gonzo. Total trust. Love it. Right off the cliff. Boom. Trust. It's right there. Some of us trust that we're going to dream and that our dreams are going to have insight in them. Some human beings walk around and they say, I don't have dreams. Actually, what that means is they don't see their dreams. That's like saying you don't see your thoughts. That's like people who say, I can't feel the middle of my back at all. I've never really felt the middle of my back. I don't have any sensations there. And then the Zen master comes up and says, feel that? Now you have a sensation. It's unconscious. So we trust the unconscious. We trust being nobody, going nowhere, knowing nothing, to some extent every night. And it's weird. If you take that away from human beings, that is one of the most profound and disturbing tortures, is to take away a person's sleep and forcefully keep them awake. We trust the change of the seasons. We trust the sun's going to come up, that the sun's going to go down. We trust gravity. Might not think of it as trust, but I'm just opening and stretching maybe this notion of trust, the sense of it, what it actually is. So we trust our instincts too. I'm mentioning a few of them. So once I was, my wife and I were interested in this spiritual teacher, she more than me, named Meher Baba. Meher Baba was a very interesting spiritual teacher who lived up until about the mid-50s. Dropped the body, passed away, depending on what you call that transition, around that time. And she had more of a connection into him and his teachings than I did. But it was a very sweet thing. I felt very, very good inside this, whatever it was that we were sharing. Call it love, maybe. He's the guy that said, by the way, it was before Bobby McFerrin said it, don't worry, be happy. Just to footnote that. Very interesting guy. He didn't bother to say, you know, I'm evolving towards God realization. He just came right out and said, I am God. And that was a bit disturbing for some people, and for other people, not at all. You can look him up, you know. He's an interesting being who did a lot of very interesting things in his life, including, I should mention, going in and getting fundamentally close with what are called the spiritually insane beings, called MUST, spelled M-A-S-T. Sounds like mast, but it's pronounced must. Musts are spiritually intoxicated beings who appear psychotic to a Western psychological mind frame. There was one in particular that I like very much. His name was Muhammad. I have a picture of him in my garage. Muhammad walked on all fours. He walked with his hands and his feet. He was bent at the waist all the time. And if a human being came near him, he grabbed whatever was available, sticks, rocks, whatever, and just threw them at people. What Meher Baba did was he went in with these musts. It was one of the beautiful things, I think, in his life, was that he gave these beings love. He gave these beings care. He knew deeply how to connect and help these beings who were, you could say, caught fundamentally, psychotically, it seemed, caught between, how should I say it? Aspects of reality. And therefore, in a sense, not able to function as we function. By the way, I should add, there's beings like this in mental hospitals in the United States of America who aren't understood in terms of what's really going on. And the people who are trying to care for them have no clue. There is no context that allows this person to be understood, and so what they ends up happening is very sad. They end up being medicated and kept under control. Thank goodness. The American Psychological Association back in the 90s made a distinction between beings that are schizophrenic and psychotic and those that are having, watch the language, spiritual religious problems. I'd love to see it evolve. Spiritual religious insights. How about situation? How about opportunity? How about awakening? At the same time I indicated that this is safe. It's safe to go all the way to the core of your direct experience. It's what we have the opportunity, if we have the opportunity, to do as part of our human life. But it's important to recognize how to do it correctly. Because there's a lot of people meditating who are going in circles in their meditation. There is a word for the circle in Buddhist psychology. It's called samsara. It means perpetual wandering. Sigmund Freud called it the repetition compulsion. Human beings are repetitiously compulsed to repeat certain things over and over as if to achieve a different result. It's called habits. So what I want to tell you about this in terms of trust is that we visited this spiritual center in South Carolina that was part of Meher Baba's life. Very simple place, no air conditioning, very rustic. I like it a lot. I haven't been there in years, but this was many years ago. Someone there had just come back from India, and they gave me this rock. It's a beautiful rock. I bonded with it immediately. Do you know how that feels when somebody gives you something and you bond? You know, it's childlike, but it's also kind of intelligent. You just like it, and you just like put it in your pocket, it feels good, or something like that. Or you put it on your table, and it goes cool. Somebody gave me a flower the other day that was iridescent from Ecuador. It was beautiful, iridescent blue and kind of yellow in there. It was just like, boom. See, we're looking at our true nature when we see objects like that, if we see them clearly. They're reflecting to us in non-conceptual, direct, non-verbal transmission what we are. It's a metaphor. Metaphor isn't the boy runs like a deer. The metaphor is the boy is a deer. It sounds weird to our conceptual mind. You are the flower. We're talking the true essence of you and the flower. You see this? This is a metaphor. So someone gave me the rock. I bond with the rock. I get in my... I had a Volkswagen then, too. I had a little rabbit. And I'm driving. I'm on a backcountry road coming back towards Florida, you know, getting up to about 60. I stick it on cruise control. Don't realize this. Fall full asleep. Full asleep. Completely unconscious. Come to. I'm at 60. I had it put it at 60, so I'm going 60 miles an hour. I don't know how far in front of me it's happening, but there's a tractor with one of those big reflective triangles on the back going about 5 miles an hour. And my car's coming up on it super fast. Total stillness, complete non-reactivity. It felt like I didn't do this. Into the left lane. Tires squealing. Into the left lane. Car coming the other way. Feels like really fast. My mind goes, he's going at least 70. Eyes. Not me, just the eyes. See a hole between the front of the tractor and the front of the car coming. I felt like I didn't do it. Put the car in that lane, back in. Tires squealing. Bang, I'm back in the lane. And then, the fear. And then the eyes spontaneously look at the rock. And then the thinking goes, thank you. Like something happened that, you know that one? I just got taken care of. Woo, 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 woo. Trust. I'll tie this in to another human being in a little bit. All spiritual teachings are about assisting us in realigning, not for the first time, but once again realigning to the ease of non-disturbance, the ease of non-reactivity, the ease of trust. All spiritual teachings are only meant to help us retrace our steps to our original nature. And thank goodness there's a wide swath of them, because we're in a space of touching on what is simple and similar. But all you have to do is take a few people and start mixing them together and letting them talk and eat and hang out, and you start to see the diversity too. You start to see the uniqueness of each being. And so this uniqueness of each being benefits immensely from the wide swath of how the teachings of truth, and this is before the mind, conceptual mind, gets a hold of the teachings and turns it into a formalization, a doctrinization, a splitting of the truth. The truth is not divided. I'll come back to that point if I can. So, all spiritual teachings are designed to help us retrace our steps to our ground of being, which is undisturbed. There is a human becoming sitting here, and there's a human being. The human becoming unfolds within the human being. The human becoming is the wheel of samsara. When the wheel of samsara, when you're in pleasant unfoldings, you feel your life is good, you like it, maybe you're comfortable, that was a great year, I got a nice sort of, you know, groove going there. Remember those times? That was nice. I had this, this happened, I love my job, you know, da-da-da, my body, blah, there's a bunch of pieces to that. And then there's the cycles of samsara where it's rougher. And you wonder, is this going to change? Is this going to stop? Is this going to go on forever? Could be a depression. Could be a period of anxiety. Could be a period of grief. Could be a period of unemployment. Could be a period of loss of, like, this doesn't feel meaningful anymore. Where do I go? Could be a loss of friends. I have a colleague in the world of psychology. That's where I spend some of my time. She's from South Africa. She got the Dutch in the blood. But her family was raised in the Sufi family. Sufi is a mystical school of Islam. And she told me pretty soon after meeting her several years ago, she said, my house and all my belongings in my house has burned down 4 times. Mm. And she said, all of that has been the most important experience of my life. If I ever see her again, which I hope I do, I'm going to ask her if I can get a chance. I'm going to ask her, tell me exactly if you can why that was the most important experiences for you. Mm. I want to hear what you have to say about that. I want to go inside that with you. I want to understand what happened there. I acutely remember her smile when she said that, hold her fingers up like this. She said, all of my possessions and my houses 4 times burned down. Most important experiences of my life. You could say that she turned it inside. She turned it inside out. There's Tibetan monks tonight who are in Chinese prisons for being freedom fighters. That's different than a terrorist in some people's minds. And they're being tortured. And their meditation practice is so strong, so clear, that they're transforming the sensations, they're transforming what's happening in their mind into compassion for themselves and their perpetrator simultaneously. That's called trust at a profound level. The possibility of our event is to fall more deeply into confirmation that this true situation, the true situation of life, the true gift of life, is to recognize the profound intelligence of the Dharma, the truth of the way things are. Even if we simply get in touch with the Dharma at a purely intellectual level, which, by the way, doesn't quite happen, because when the intellect actually opens to truth teachings or the Dharma, something happens in the body and the heart too. You can actually go through the intellect. There's a whole style of yoga where you go through the intellect into the heart and into the true nature. It's a path. It's a way. This intelligence that brings inherent with it the awakening context. Everyone in this room is awakening. Every human being is awakening. Now, if you take some people's definition of awakening, they'll say, well, this kind of thing had to happen for awakening to be happening. Prior to that, there really wasn't awakening. Well, what do you call that in there? Pre-awakening? Warming up for awakening? Not ready for awakening? Some people define awakening as the first glimpse of non-separateness, consciously. And I would say to that, that everybody in this room has tasted degrees of non-separateness, has tasted degrees of intimacy with life, has tasted degrees of non-separateness. What's going to be the criteria in there? You know what? You. And it should be that way. But if you don't trust yourself, then you tend to listen to someone else who suggests to you the way it is, and you see if that fits for you. Now it's got to come back and register and resonate for you. Otherwise, you're probably not going to stay with it. So the context of awakening, not the content. What's that mean? The context of awakening is this shared space. Here's a word. This shared space of common interest and care towards something as simple as meditation. Meditation retreat, residential meditation, I want to do this. Everybody else wants to do this, that's why we're here in part. It's Friday night, still a little early. Some of us, if we didn't want to be meditating, we'd be going out. Getting warmed up, ready to go. Party. Dinner. Music. Little of this, little of that. Conversation. Or someone else would be quietly at home, reading a book. Listening to music there. Possibly meditating on their own. I know such a person doing that tonight. He wanted to be here. There wasn't enough room. So he said, I'll do it at home. I said, good for you. It's a context of interconnectedness. And when we begin to sense this, it extends easily and wonderfully beyond this room. It goes out and opens and includes more and more and more, because what it starts to do is it starts to tap into that which is boundless. It starts to tap into that which doesn't have a limit. This is the context of awakening. Here's an example. You're interacting with someone and they start to tell you about something wonderful that's happening for them. And instead of your mind going into comparison, you go, oh, wow, that sounds wonderful. I feel not so good about myself suddenly. I really haven't had anything like that lately. In fact, I've never had anything like that. And I'm starting to not like you so much. Actually, I'm feeling the urge to change the subject and just distract you, because this is starting, I'm feeling jealousy or envy starting to come up. It doesn't happen, let's say. And what happens instead is this just goes, and you feel what's called sympathetic joy. That's joy in another person's good fortune. And there's a connection, some degree of release of separateness. It's that simple. And then it goes away. You might notice that woven through all those examples, I didn't say it explicitly, so here it comes, woven through all those examples of trust, we begin to actually more and more deeply trust the Dharma through the direct realization of change. Change of the seasons, change of the state of mind, change of the feelings, change. I think, maybe you would too, that that friend from South Africa really had a trust in change to have four houses and all the thing in those houses burned down. Some minds would go with that. What are you not paying attention to? I mean, it's interesting to have everything in your belongings and house, you know, go once. Are you not locking your door? what's going on? We're a very, at times, fickle and biased bunch. And then it's gone again. There it goes again. It doesn't last. That means it can't be what you really are, because what you really are doesn't come and go. The awakening context begins to reveal not just that everything's changing, but there's something here that seems to not necessarily only be about change. And the only way I know of to begin to see this is through direct experience and trusting the meditation, if you will, of direct experience. We're not going to get it so readily just if we stay in the intellect. It's like trying to get the benefit of a great massage by thinking about it the whole time. Wow, that was a great stroke. Why don't you do that again? That felt wonderful. It's bifurcated. Partly feeling and then partly thinking. It's okay. Because if it's not okay, there's another issue, huh? This okayness, this trust of okayness, has nothing to do with passivity. It's incredibly engaged and active. But what this awakening context reveals is more and more and more and more what is not in your dominion to control or even regulate. We're going to go back to that a little later here, around who thinks they're driving the car here. This is the image I gave before dinner about in the bucket seat and take the bucket belts off. That's about realizing there is no one driving the car. Life is living through your perception of yourself. Life's in charge, just like the weather is in charge of itself. You ever find a big cheese running the weather? It's not there. Not in the way we think about it. I used to think the big cheese were the guy with a big beard up there. White. Santa Claus-like. Big, rosy-cheeked, loving, sweet, can I get in your lap type guy. It's imagination. We start to appreciate this magnificent wonder of the natural world, not just some of the examples I'm giving, but more and more the beauty and the wonder of it. And we start to directly see, realize that our thoughts and our intentions and our motivations, as interesting as those are extremely small and really have nothing to do with this, if you will, creation of this natural world. And we can't grasp with our thinking and our intentions the incredible subtlety of the grain of sand or the way in which the wind moves and the way in which the moon reflects. Yes, it's reflecting. And because it's reflecting, it's shining. We can't grasp the subtlety of it, nor can we grasp the boundlessness of it. And instead of that being something that we, well, you know, struggle with, it just lets go. The thoughts let go. The intentions let go. The trying to understand it lets go. And the more this realization ripens, the more we're released from trying to make our fundamental experience of life different or better through effort, thought, and intention. Now, let me be clear about this. If you have a particular thing you want to do, like with work or something, and you put your thoughts and your intention and your motivation and your energy, your time and your money into that, and maybe other people's help, and you do something, you create something, or you're part of creating something. Okay, that's fine. That's great. But in terms of insights that help us realize our spiritual nature, You don't control that. You don't make that happen with your mind. In fact, your mind is actually exposed. Your thinking conditioned, effortful, directed mind is actually an impediment. It's part of what's in Hinduism called Maya, or illusion. It's part of samsara in Buddhism, perpetual wandering. So let's be very practical. I hope that I am practical with this. There's a reliability, an increasingly deep and full, broadened, mature reliability in the power of relaxing. Relaxing. As that matures, as that develops, it takes moments of full commitment to see through any and all apparent conflict and turmoil in your mind, in your world, in your relationships, to see through it, to not be held or imprisoned by it. It's actually the movement of compassion. Again, from the Buddhist teachings, it's described sometimes as this commitment to the sure heart's release, the sure heart's release, the heart that is sure of the possibility of release, release from impediment, from conflict, from turmoil. And we are very subtle and yet durable beings. We can tolerate a lot of conflict and turmoil. We can actually take a lot, like a Michelin tire almost. Take a lot. But that doesn't mean we're also not incredibly sensitive and subtle and capable of profound transparency. Even a relative to how long residentials sometimes go on, short weekend, the transparency of the skin, the transparency of the breathing, the transparency of thoughts, the transparency, the empty, open nature of experience can show itself. Empty of what? Empty of permanence. Empty of what? Empty of solidity. Empty of what? Empty of anyone who owns it. You don't have to be nearing your deathbed or sitting posture. Stephen and I were talking about a teacher named Sri Yukteswar who died full meditation posture. And then when the life force left, he just started to do the body started to do this. May we all be so fortunate as to be so clear whether we're lying down, sitting, whatever the posture is, so that we see what's available when it's time to breathe the last. We're in training for that right now. So what's this rationality of relaxation, this reliability of relaxation telling us? What's the trust? It's telling us that it's completely logical and practical to have the skill of relaxing into every situation. And it is one of the mandates for awakening. It's fundamental. As relaxation, as trust, or trust as relaxation grows, through the whole body-mind process, we realize it's wholesome, it's nurturing, and we trust its effects. When and where difficulties come out, when we're relaxed and responding to those difficulties, we see clearly for ourselves how this helps the situation. No matter what the problem is, no matter how complicated, no matter how difficult, if you're more relaxed in response to it, it's just simple logic. But it's a deep insight at the same time. By the way, a lot of the deep insights are completely, utterly common sense.
Now,
there's relaxation that has conditioned expectation inside it. I will relax so that this can then happen. I will relax so that hopefully this can then happen. I won't get too uptight here because that won't help. I'll relax so that hopefully this and that will happen. We start programming where the relaxation is going to go, we hope. You've done this? Okay, that's called conditioned relaxation. It's part of samsara. There's another kind of relaxation called unconditioned relaxation. And that's relaxation that has no expectation. It's not trying to go anywhere. It's not trying to develop something next. I'll relax so that. I used to do this a lot with yoga. I do the yoga, and then I get in my shavasana, the corpse pose, and I'd relax. You know why? So I could feel certain ways. I could feel at ease. I could feel freedom from thought. I could feel sort of maybe kind of float out of my body a little bit sometimes if I got lucky. So always going for a little result there. And after a while I realized, I have no idea what's motivating this, except that it feels good. You see, this is really important. We do trust our feelings, I hope we do. But at the same time, if we live according to what our feelings tell us, too much, for example, it feels good, keep doing it. It doesn't feel good, stop. For example, if it didn't occur to us already that when you sit here for 45 minutes, that's how long we've been sitting roughly for the sittings, have you noticed that sometimes in the body it feels worse than when you started? And the best part of the sitting is when the bell rings. Now, I've heard it many times over the years that people start to kind of get this sense of the bell ringing and the liking of it, and the mind goes straight forward. It just says, he's out of it. He's asleep. He started sitting like this. His head's drooping. He's asleep. I'm going to ring that bell myself. I'll end the sitting. This cannot be good for me. This is damage. I'm damaging the tissue. Damaging the bones. This can't be good for my butt. Reaction. It's fear, actually. It's delusion. If you sit here and force the posture, that's not a good idea. But if you sit and you relax into the stillness, my suggestion would be only good, only illumination comes from that. Interesting. Part of freedom is realizing that you are free to be interested or not interested in anything. Right now. You want to not be interested in something? You want to really not be interested in something? Just experiment with the freedom of denial. I don't want to look. Don't want to see. Just notice that. It's part of freedom. No. No more, no less than yes. Oh, look, what's this? What's going to happen? What will happen if the relaxation moves into a more unconditioned space and it's not so programmed towards a result, a goal, a direction, a place, a better place, a different place, a more comfortable place? How about an enlightened place? How about a place where there's no disturbance ever again? I heard that might be what it is, I say to myself. You know what enlightenment is? Completely indescribable. It's not a thing, it's not an experience, it's not a feeling, it's not a thought. It is completely and utterly indescribable. There is no word. It's funny to use the word enlightenment. Where does that word go? By the way, have you noticed? No one knows. It doesn't go anywhere. There is no place to go to. But yet it's supposed to be the pinnacle of your human nature. And we've been indoctrinated into thinking about it, hearing about it, hearing the strange mix of contradiction about it, what it is, what it isn't. And yet some human beings, nonetheless, no matter how confused and mixed up it is, some human beings along the way completely trust in the possibility. Without conflicting their lives by carrying around ideas and programming and conditioned relaxation that's trying to bring you to someplace better than where you are. The Balinese, it's a mix of Muslim and Hindu faith there mostly. The Hindus, particularly in Bali, they have a view, it's a view, that the best place to be reborn, they believe in rebirth. Actually, excuse me, they believe in reincarnation, that's different. The best place to be reincarnated is exactly where they currently are in the exact situation they're currently in. That's Mary Oliver's poem. By the way, I'm going nowhere. Are you following me? You see, I'll come back to the wisdom of no escape in a minute. Non-interfering awareness. The nature of awareness is non-interfering. Let me describe how that functions, because we all have this, and to see it more clearly, to see how it works, is where the medicine for what ails us lies. It's where the mandate for awakening becomes clear. It's where we see what meditation really can offer. When we begin to discover the beauty and the grace and the simplicity of bare attention, which sometimes is called mindfulness, and find that not only is this the most intelligent way to live your life, from a foundation, a base, but it's the door into your true nature. The power of attending that is free from three things: judgment, decision, and commentary. This is called bare attention. Bare of making decisions, judging, better or worse, and various degrees of commentary. Have you noticed how much commentary is in the mind? Quite a commenter up there. Some of us have a committee. And it's actually not someone else. You see, you didn't really actually take someone else's thought in there. That's actually your original thought, so to speak. And then another thought, and another thought, and another thought. So it's free from that for a moment. It's free from the commentary. It's free from the decision. It's free from the judgment. Even free from one of those, free from judgment. Bare attention, free from judgment. Beautiful. Bare attention, free from needing to make a decision about this. Free from a commentary. We've all had it. What we're pointing at here is the possibility that we don't have to just have it by chance, by luck, by good fortune. We have it because we begin to realize actually what it is. It's the good wolf. We begin to see what it is. We begin to attend to attention. And then we find that wellspring of interest starting to emerge, right there inside that space of attention. It's not partial or biased interest. At first, our interest is bias. It's particular and it's biased. It's opinionated. It's commented. It's judging. And then the interest frees into this unbiased, undivided, and that's our natural abiding starting to show up, this undivided, open interest. Notice it if it's around at all. At first, it's very subtle. Part of the reason why this process of waking up, if you want to call it that, seems at times difficult is because it's very subtle. We are trained and habituated to overlook subtleties. Mm-hmm. to even think they're not meaningful or sensationalized. Sometimes the expectation wants something big to happen, something huge that shifts me. I want the effects of the primal scream without the scream. So this unbiased, relaxed, open interest, our natural abiding, it's uncontrived, and we begin to see that it's actually effortless. The nature of this interest is effortless, it's spontaneous. Don't have to be concerned about where the electricity is that feeds it. Just notice that it's alive and vibrant and vital. Oh, by itself in a way. No matter what's occurring, very important, no matter what's occurring, this is very important. Because here's the equanimity. These qualities don't just happen singularly, they happen in concert with one another. Concentration, interest, equanimity, tranquility, they're called the factors of awakening. They work synergistically. But it's nice to be able to identify them distinctly. They're not separate, but they can be distinguished. When experience seems more complicated, which it inevitably does at times, confused or conflicted, this clear, relaxed abiding seems to get covered up. We even believe it's gone. We even believe we've lost it. Actually, all that's happened is it's been veiled. It's just like clouds coming over the sun. The sun doesn't go away. No matter how thick the clouds, no matter how long the clouds last, the sun doesn't go away. Thich Nhat Hanh, I mentioned him this morning. Thich Nhat Hanh wrote a book. Funny thing about my life, and in a way, and things I get to do, is that sometimes people give me really, really wonderful things. You know, that happens sometimes. People give you wonderful things. There's a period in my life, it's not happening so much now, where people give me really wonderful books, really, really great books, and write something beautiful in the front of the book, like the woman who went through Auschwitz and unbelievably found her way and survived. All the family members were lost. They either gave up or were killed along the way. When you gave up in those situations, you died fast. You had to want to live. Right through the camps she went as a little girl, just like this. Boo, 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 boo. Oh, right there, that paragraph right there, it looked like that's you could have died right there really easily. Boom, slipped by somehow, miraculously. Came out the other side, beautiful, elegant, graceful. That's mindfulness in motion, graceful woman. Wrote a beautiful book about her experiences. Her son gave me the book. She wrote in the front of the book this passage as if I was her best friend. She never met me. Trust. And there it is at the end of the book. The big family now, the grandchildren, the nieces, the nephews, the big wedding. There she is, elegant, beautiful, having been profoundly, deeply, continually, unbelievably tortured, and yet somehow made it through. The Sun, My Heart, that was Thich Nhat Hanh's book. He called it The Sun, My Heart. Trust as relaxation takes you out of and through every bind. So, a year ago, my birth mother was nearing the end of her life, and I had the great opportunity to have a week of meditation with her, and I mean that in the full sense of the way I'm talking, and we're talking about meditation. We got in the bucket seat together. 94 years old, pelvis is cracked. The pneumonia has set in. She's stopped eating. She's pulling out slowly and not drinking, although she still really is liking that kombucha. And she's going with the sweetest tone, "I just like the strawberry so much. Can I have just a sip?" Knowing in the back of her mind, if she sips that, she's going to live longer, and she's wanting to die. It's interesting. I looked her in the eye and I said, "Mom, I feel you have an opportunity to die really well. Her eyes gleamed. She looked back at me and she said, yes. And I said, and if I can help, I would be so honored. And she said, you are helping. So she started giving teachings during that week. Little things like time. She just comes out with this. Time has wings. And she moves her hands like this. What was happening there for me was time was going away. Thoughts were dissipating. I realized that I had a very beautiful opportunity, that I could protect her. I could protect her somewhat. Not entirely, but I could protect her a little bit from the chaos and the neurosis of her mind and the mind of other offspring. Because I knew, I'd known it from childhood, that the conflict between her and my sisters and her and my brother at times was profound and fundamentally dysfunctional, to the point where no communication is happening. Will not, cannot talk. Talk about separation, huh? Here's what happened. It's about trust. Coming down the last couple days, she's not talking anymore. She's sitting up. The pneumonia's drying up. It's called dehydration. Common way to go. She's breathing a lot through the mouth. Back of her mouth, back there, it looks all raw. It's almost bleeding back there. Looks really uncomfortable. The last hospice caregiver came in. Energetically, she seemed frayed to me as soon as she appeared. My felt sense was one of nervousness. She came in and seemed committed to doing her job. And so what she did was she looked in my mom's mouth and she said, oh, we got to swab that out. And I felt inside, I'm not sure. But she was committed to her job. So she got out her equipment and the whatever that was. It was like Q-tip and stuff. And she dabbed it in the stuff and put it in there. And my mother's body just started shaking. And she made sounds. And it was agonizing for about 5 seconds. And the impulse came up to grab the woman. And like, don't do that. Watched it unfold. I think she realized it wasn't such a good idea. And backed off. And my mom's body went from because where she was before that was just bucket seat, no seatbelt. She's in the groove. Definitely in the groove. She's smooth, easy, peaceful. Right back. Appear, disappear. The feeling I had, because I couldn't talk, right? So the feeling I had was, you saw right through that. Somebody just came in and bothered you again. Can't know for sure, it just felt that way. Back abiding in that trust, abiding in that space. Was she non-abiding during the... Can't say. Trust is handy when it's smooth, and the trust is handy when it's rough. It's handy all the time. True freedom is not a state of mind. It's not a state of feeling. It's rather a clear, open, unbounded, spacious trust. And life is appearing in that. Consider it like the sky. When we relax into our experience, many insights come. Many, many insights come. Here's just two. One, We recognize that any state of mind, floats in and through this abiding presence. And that experience actually is free upon arising. It's not going to become free. It's free to arise. This is where you become freed up from needing to practice acceptance. Because when you are involved in practicing acceptance, you will inevitably be challenged by the places that you don't yet accept. When you begin to see that experience itself, prior to your notion of yourself accepting or not accepting experience, has already been allowed, because it wouldn't appear if it wasn't already allowed. Now you're seeing what in Tibetan Buddhism is called Dzogchen, the great allowance, or the great natural perfection. It's a very subtle point, but notice this. Nothing can arise unless it has been allowed prior to your mind accepting it or not accepting it. What this does is it uproots the tendency to split acceptance from non-acceptance, because acceptance and non-acceptance split is a expression of conditioned relaxation. It's not only this floating through, but experience is inseparable from that which is experiencing it. This is a more subtle point. At first, it seems like the seeing or the watching, the awareness, is apart from what's happening. I remember this distinctly when it first started to occur in my life, where I could actually see what was happening. I could see fear, I could see anger, I could see the pain in the knee. I could see it, and it seemed like I, quote unquote, was apart from it. You follow this? If you don't feel you're apart from that which is happening, then you feel completely caught in what's happening. I remember that too. But what happens is you feel like you kind of lift off, or you lift out, or you kind of get some room there to breathe and see it. You don't react so much. You're observing it. You relax. And it's a big relief. It's much more sane way to live than being caught up in everything. But as the trust deepens, not only is it clear, not only is it seen that there's no separation between experience and what sees experience, but there actually is no experiencing or experiencer, excuse me, of experience. There's no one in here experiencing what's happening. There's no discrete thing or entity in here that you can call you. Look and see. It's immediate. Where are you? Body sitting? Breathing happening? Sense organs happening? Somebody talking? Hand moving? Where are you? The answer to that is, you don't exist as you think you do. Or another way to say it, your thoughts about yourself are simply only thoughts. What's happening then? There's a constant stream of constantly changing experience and awareness that is inseparable from what's happening. What's happening is not fundamentally good or bad, high or low, young or old, male or female, or even yin or yang. These labels that I just named are actually just that. They're interpretations, they're labels, and what they do is they function as something that we actually put upon experience in an attempt to understand it or organize it with our brain. And here's the trick. Through that organization of experience through our brain, we attempt to subtly, in some cases, try to control it. And when that moves out into the mind trying to conceptualize and control its way to freedom or to enlightenment or to any attainment of that nature, not talking about like I want to build my business to a certain point and do this or that, that's different. Freedom can't be conceptualized because it's beyond all perceptions. That's its nature. It's like the open sky or the still forest pool or the deep dreamless sleep state. It's like those things. The mind conflates. It's a good word. The mind conflates. It blows together ideas of freedom with states and feelings and nice things, and then tries to get to where it thinks the goal is by changing itself. What a weird, strange thing to do. Efforting to change what you are to become something that you think is better. First of all, that's not fair to the part of you that started. Second of all, if you try this for a while, you realize that all you're doing at best is moving the furniture around in the room. It doesn't change the room at all. Because you don't need to change the room. What you need to do is see the room. Here's the way I first saw this in my life. I remembered this a couple days ago. This effort to try to conceptualize your way to attainment or to freedom or to a peace that maybe, if you're lucky, passes all understanding is a bit like trying to redirect a beetle pushing a hunk of dirt. I don't know whether you've ever done this. There's the beetle pushing a hunk of dirt. It's bigger than the beetle. That's interesting. It's bigger than the beetle, and it's pushing the hunk of dirt. And you put your finger down and you redirect it. And then what it does is it turns around from where you redirected it, and it lines up exactly where it was going before, and it keeps going in the same direction. And then you do it again, and it does the same thing again. You ever done that? It's really interesting, to me at least. This is where the part of the talk makes me feel very, very neurotic over here when I say something like this and you sit there. Perhaps never having played with a beetle the way I used to. It's okay, though. You get the drift of what I'm pointing at, I hope. Here's the beetle working for its survival. It must do this. That's its nature. But when we do that kind of dirt-pushing move and redirect it and redirect it and redirect it, I hope at first, I want to say this, we really know what we're doing. Why are we doing this? Why are we so committed to something? When you realize that you cannot see what it is, you can't even think about what it is in any real way that you really want, except via notions of the absence of what you don't want. That you cannot conceptualize freedom. Then something shifts in terms of your orientation to your life, your spiritual practice, your meditation. You are fundamentally somewhat more humbled by the inability of your mind, brain, to conceptualize the result. And something very important is turning there. The Tibetans call it the turning of the mind, the turning of the conditioned mind. Inside and all around this wheel of samsara, there is the wheel of dharma, the wheel of truth. It's right here with that which seems problematic, troubled, strained. It's hiding inside. So we get clear about this make-believe game that goes on in our heads about a better future. And then we begin to get closer to what I'd call the punchline of massive relief. the closest we can ever get, seemingly, to our true nature with words is to say what it's like via like an image, the sky, or perhaps a metaphor, or we can try to describe what it's not. And some beings have a way of putting words together that's very potent and interesting and unique. And here's one set. The poet Hafiz said it like this. He named this short poem A Strange Feather. All the craziness, all the empty plots, all the ghosts and fears, all the grudges and sorrows have now passed. I must have inhaled a strange feather that finally fell out. Here's how the punchline really lands. The punchline about this make-believe story in the head, in the body. Because what goes on in here neurologically goes right through this thing sometimes, all the way down to the toes. It's as if the toes themselves believe the thought as much as this part of the brain right here. When we begin to directly experience the reliability, the assurance, the conviction of abiding, relaxed presence, no matter what the conditions, no matter what the feeling, no matter what the state, no matter what the age, no matter what the thought, it becomes like gravity. It becomes like the very atmosphere we live in. It becomes that intimate. I don't think it's right to say it becomes a habit. It'd be better to say it's the end of habit, it's the death of habit. You begin to see you are the atmosphere of openness. You are the sitting. You are what's happening. And as you see you are this, you see you're free amidst it. You see what it is that can't be held, contained, limited. You see and realize the ground of being. And this ground of being is not the earth ground. This ground of being is the groundless ground. It includes this and everything else. It's groundless ground. It's an atmosphere of relaxed trust. And into this atmosphere of relaxed trust, we add a little bit of an elixir called some teachings that point things out. If we were really ripe, we don't need to hear the teachings. We don't need to go anywhere. We don't need anything at all. But because we think we're not free, we're not complete, we're not whole, we're not free, then we think we need something to help us get free. And as that begins to unpack itself, that subtle samsaric wheel in our mind-body, we begin to see liberation from need. It's not just liberation from wants, it's liberation from needs, perceived needs. It's really called right view in the Buddhist teachings, correct view. it's in the atmosphere of relaxed trust that this pointing out can take place a little bit more easily than over in McDonald's. Although sometimes that could work too if folks are ready. It's about ripeness. Has nothing to do with striving, has nothing to do with thinking, it has nothing to do with efforting. So why am I sitting here at times seemingly applying effort? And here's why. Because in order to see that awareness is spontaneously, effortlessly here, many human beings need a bit of a warm-up for that. Why do you think there's so much preparation in the yogas of the world so that you can actually just sit and meditate? We're going to do this and this and this and this and this and this. It's going to take about 20 years, and now you can sit and have a meditation. And there's some logic to that. But at the same time, if you're waiting around, if your idea of waking up is viewed along the lines of something linear and progressive, now you're on a gerbil wheel. And you're looking for something outside or beyond or past where you are. The only place you can look to see the truth is into what is actually happening. So here it works like this. When you realize that there's no escape from what's happening, and this is very important to kind of do this in the right place and time, like on a meditation cushion, is a good place to do this. And that how, when, where, and even to whom things are happening, these labels, is utterly inescapable. And there's a complete trust and alignment with this inescapability, which means there's a moment or more of complete non-resistance. Then, momentarily, there is no more fuel for suffering or striving. And this is when boundlessness appears. This is when going beyond appears. And it might only be for a second. Going beyond appears every night in deep sleep, but we miss it most of the time. We actually get the sense of going beyond in the memory trace of having gone beyond. When we wake up, that was nice. Back there, that's a memory trace out of the deep sleep state back into the waking state. This momentary release from the fuel, the petrol, it feeds suffering and striving and limitation. It's not a feeling, although feelings are changed by it. It's not a thing, it's not a qualifiable thing, although the things, like your thoughts, are changed by it. I can't really say it very well, other than it's like the open sky. It doesn't interfere with what's in it. It simply allows. And then as a backwash to that, whenever there's trying to stop something that's already happening, you really see clearly conflict is born right there, boom. And whenever there is trying to create something better out of what is happening, again, subtle conflict is born right there. Boom, you see it. Just like Steve talked about that step. You see the first second of the in-breath. And the same way you see the first second of the in-breath, you see that space, you see that way in which conflict is born. You see it clearly. And as you see it clearly, it releases. Now, think about this for a second. A lot of people are very busy tonight and a lot of their life doing everything they can to not look into the place where conflict is happening. They're doing the opposite of that. They're trying to look into the places that don't have conflict. And then conflict is chasing them and finds them, tracks them down, and the medications are given. Right? And the distraction techniques. And even the cognitive behavioral shift your mind technique comes in. Avoid it. Step past it. You don't have to do that. You don't have to see that. And sometimes it works, temporarily. Do you want to move the furniture in the house around? Or do you want to liberate yourself from the limits of the house? We're free either way. If you want to liberate yourself from the limits of the house, you need to want it, and you need to recognize how it can happen.
Okay, just a few more words. And this will tie into the teachings again tomorrow. So we're building, in a way, towards nothing. Because awareness is a no thing. Put a hyphen between the no and the thing. You see this right now. Notice that awareness is not an object of knowledge. See if you can see this right now. Awareness is not an object of knowledge. Notice this. Notice that you cannot localize, you cannot find awareness. You cannot find where it is, and yet it is. Everybody agrees that awareness is. Can you notice that you can't localize where it is? See this now. You cannot find a center for awareness. Look and see. Notice this now. Notice that you cannot find the edge of awareness. It has no periphery. There comes a moment for all of us when we're looking into the mirror, maybe as children, maybe even now, any time, looking into the mirror, and there's a falling away of the thought of mirror and the thought of yourself, and there's simply the seeing. When you investigate for the nature of the mind, when you investigate for the nature of anything, what you find is a space. It's just a word. A space opens and there's nothing there. That's awareness. It's an empty, naked, uncontrived cognizance, not a thought. Most human beings, if they're not identified with experience, they're identified with being conscious. This is called an idea that claims awareness as its own. Meanwhile, awareness sees the idea of the mind clinging to awareness as itself. Again, very terse, very clear, very beautiful, simple words. This is from Rumi. He says it differently than Hafiz, but similar. Feel his words. He says, I lived on the lip of insanity, wanting to know reasons, knocking on a door, it opens. I've been knocking from the inside. This is the wisdom of no escape. This is the wisdom of the power and the illumination of abiding awareness that has no agenda, has no limits, isn't conditioned, is not possessible. Can't be located, and yet it is. It shifts us a little or a lot out of the progression towards anything better. Anything different. Anything nicer, because that's all actually fundamentally unsatisfactory to keep going for. It's like a carrot that just keeps moving away. There's a point in all seekers' lives where that process becomes utterly, fundamentally exhausting and unsatisfactory. And now you're right. We just want to shorten up the time so you don't have to spend a lot of time doing something that doesn't work. The strange thing is we have to do a lot of things sometimes that don't really work until we see that they don't work, and then we don't need to do them anymore. There's a shortcut sometimes, and right now I'll just complete the talk with this. The shortcut, and we'll work on this, play with this, explore this further as we go, is to begin to recognize that which sees experience, to recognize awareness itself. not what awareness can do, what you think you can do with it, what it is. And if you touch a little bit of the edges of that, or more than the edges of that, you find inherently in it there's peace. Inherently in it there's love. Inherently in it there's joy. Inherently in it there's happiness. Inherently in it there's presence. Inherently in it there's you. And not a conceptualized, storied you. It's the natural abiding you. And when you see this, you see this has always been here. Every moment of recognition of this, as far back as they go in the historical memory mind, you see it line up like dominoes. It's the exact same thing. Not a thing. It's the exact same nature. And here's another piece, we'll end on this. The other piece is it's exactly that same nature that's happening through every other human. Every other human being. You can look in cow's eyes and see it, fish eyes and see it. Eventually you see it in the blade of grass, the wind, the sky, the bird song. The taste of the banana. The recognition is there, coming through the reflection of every experience. That's the unconditioned nature of awareness. It has no conditions. No experience limits it. It's what sees and recognizes everything.